I don't know about you, but I have really been looking forward to this workshop on conditions as a guide to relationships. I understand the traditions as unity for our group, but I had never thought about it as a way to better my relationships with others. So I know that you're just as eager as I am for this workshop today, and so we will get on with it, and Elaine will come and introduce our leader.
Hi, I am Elaine. I'm a grateful covering Al-Anon. This is a very special day for me because this lady was a big part of my recovery when I first got started in Al-Anon. So I've got a kind of a cold. But she's very special, and she's given me a lot of hope and ways in learning of these tools. And I just want everyone to give her a good Mississippi welcome. Here is Mary Pearl.
Like rats from a ship, you know. My name is Mary Pearl, and they call me the Murph, and I am grateful to be back in Mississippi. Thank you. That's just so I can see what I need to see down here. Working the traditions in the relationship, I thought I'd give you, start off with a little background on how this came about for me. In the 12 and 12 of AA, that non-conference approved material that we been using, it says that the unity of AA and Al-Anon is the most cherished quality of our fellowship, and our lives and the lives of all to come depend squarely upon it. The 12 steps put our life in order, but not necessarily our relationships. So how do you live successfully with others is found within the traditions. So they're the guidelines for our behavior, and it never occurred to me that that was what they were designed for. I was like Joyce this morning, and I always looked at the traditions of these are how we keep our group together. And you know, it occurred to me, though, if we're groups of sick people, we're admittedly sick people, you know, it's the only place you come there and you're all together, and after the longer you stay there, the sicker you get, because awareness happens, you know, and you find out that maybe the only sick person in the house wasn't the alcoholic, you know. And for a long time I was working on my personal recovery and he was working on his personal recovery. But we still had big relationship problems. Now, I know that probably hasn't happened to you. They got sober and you lived happily ever after, probably. That's the reason you're here, I assume. But that didn't happen in our house. In fact, sometimes things got worse. And we couldn't understand what was happening. And then I saw a very staggering statistic a few years ago. And that was that a lot of times people with long-time membership in Al-Anon, married to someone with long-time sobriety, were getting divorced. And that scared me, because I looked at it this way. I'd stayed with that sucker through a lot of garbage, and I'd be darned that now that he's sober, I'm going to give him up. You know, I went through the hell. I want some of the gravy if you want it, you know. And I said, so what's happening? Because it was a lot of people in our fellowship. A great number of my close friends seemed to be getting divorced. And I'm saying, what is happening? And I'm talking about over 15 or 20 years in the program, in both programs. And that's scary. That is scary. And it became apparent after a while. I began to do a survey because, see, I'm a researcher. And I began to survey these people as to what the problem was, just what was the problem in your deal, why did y'all break up? Because I wanted to know if there was a common thread, you know, in this, and there was. Everybody was so busy doing their own thing that they had no more us. Everybody was focusing so much on self. You know, when we come in here, our total focus is on the alcoholic, as a rule. And then we tell them, take it off the alcohol, put it on yourself. And then without realizing it, we get into self real well now, because that's your problem. Everything now becomes, you know, we are the ones, you know, we're working, I'm doing this for my recovery. I have to do this, it's good for me. And I'm sure none of you have had this attitude or thought that way, but that was a big deal in our house. That was a big deal, and that seemed to be the eternal comeback for everything. Well, I have to do this for my recovery. If you don't like it, that's tough. You know, we didn't, and it occurred to me also, all my life I've had relationship problems. Have you ever had a really healthy relationship? And I'm saying to myself, no, I never really have. Now, a lot of my relationships had gotten tremendously better by the fact that I was working on myself and the fact that I was allowing God to work in my life and remove some character defects to some extent. I have not been totally removed of any defects that I'm aware of. I still have areas of growth in all these defect. But our relationship was getting better in some ways, but in other ways I could see that I was going my way and doing my thing, and he was going his way and doing his thing, and there wasn't much our thing. And that began to scare me, because I began to see this common thread that was in all these people that had broken up, that we needed to develop a relationship together. We need to work on communication. There was a lot of things that needed improvement in our home. But being how I have never had a real healthy relationship, where do you start? And how do you do it? I had no idea. And then, like I say, I was sitting there one night reading these traditions, and I had talked with a couple of friends of mine in the program. One of them was a priest in the program. And he was talking about, he had been considering the concept of the tradition. So he and I got together and we shared some thoughts and what have you. And I began to pray about it and study about it. And we began to share things and we evolved what I am going to share with you today. And I took it to my group. Now I want to start off by telling you right on the front end, this is not conference approved material. So if that has to be, I'll let you leave now so you won't be offended. Because it's a new idea, fairly new. On how to do it, so it has not had any sanction as of yet. But I can tell you, we've been working it as a group for 2 years at my home group. We voted through our autonomy that we would have this meeting, and it is an open meeting, and we find that we have just as many of the alcoholics that come that want to do better about their relationships as we do. And we have shared our experiences together and what we were doing that didn't work, and we have tried to come up with things that have. And all of us, we had a couple of marriages that were almost completely out, and now we have had some reconciliations and things are doing a lot better. So what I'm telling you is, it's working. This may not be the final result, but this is where we're going to start from today. Now, there's that page of notes I haven't even looked at. If the 12 tradition can keep a group of sickies together and functioning pretty well, then why couldn't we do it in the relationship? That's all it amounts to. Now, it doesn't have to be your marriage relationship. We have a bunch of singles that come. But anytime you are being around another person, you have a potential for a relationship. I didn't realize I have relationships with lots of people. With the drivers on the road. I had them with the people at the grocery store. I had a very sick relationship with a checkout lady. She personally offended me by tallying up my bill. I can remember as a child going to the grocery store was fun. That's before you have to pay for them. And with the rate of inflation over the years, I don't know why, but I had just turned a negative attitude toward her because she represented, and I hate going to the grocery store and putting out all that money and taking home so little. And that would irritate me, and without realizing it, I had a very sick relationship with this woman at the checkout. That's the best way I can put it. She hated to see me coming. I hated to have to go through her line, but yet I insisted on going through her line and inflicting her rather than trying to break in someone new. I know you. Most women have a favorite checkout. You get used to going to a certain person, and I would go to her, and I think it was the sickness that attracted us to one another. Okay, the way some of the traditions are going to be reworded a little, and some of them are going to be reworded a lot, but we have tried to maintain the principle contained within in applying it to the relationship. The first tradition is pretty much the same. Our common welfare comes first. A healthy relationship depends upon unity. Now, what is unity? Now, I know in the group, I can't even talk this morning, in the group it meant the greatest good for the greatest number. Well, how do you do that in your house or with a person when it's just two of you? You know, the greatest good is what I want. And that's really how I saw it. We laugh, but that's how I saw it. Because, see, intuitively, I've always knew better. I always know what's best for me and everybody else. Intuitively, I know that. And that's that self-centeredness that we work on in the program. Well, I found that our first thing in developing unity in a relationship, I have to have unity in the most important relationship of my life, and that's with my higher power. And it never occurred to me that when I was in self-will, I was out of unity. So I'm going to tell you, I don't think it's possible to work these traditions that well until you have a working knowledge of the steps, because you're going to have to fall back on how to work to get rid of your character defects and work on your relationships with your higher power, which we establish when we come through our 12 steps. So the steps are going to be the basis of my personal recovery, and I'm going to have a pretty good hold on that. But that doesn't mean it's just like going to step meetings and you're a newcomer and they're talking about the 12 steps. You can get a general idea that will help you later on. So if you can't use it today, file it away and use it later. I hate the phrase, take what you want and leave the rest. And the reason I hate that phrase is I took what was easy and I left what was hard. I left what I needed to be doing. So I take what I can use now and I store the rest. I don't leave it because I might miss out on something, and I'm a very greedy person. I want everything this program has to offer. Now, living with an alcoholic damaged my relationships, and it damaged my unity with a higher power. You know, I felt for a long time a lot of bitterness about having lived in alcoholism. I don't know if y'all did that or not. I heard a story the other day that reminded me somewhat of how I felt. A doctor went to a lady and he told her, he said, I hate to tell you this, but you have terminal cancer. And at the most, you have 6 months to live. And she said, oh my God, what can I do? He said, well, you can marry an alcoholic. You'll seem a hell of a lot longer. And that's how I felt. Isn't that terrible? They tell so many tacky Al-Anon jokes, I just can't resist that one. It's difficult. It's very difficult to work out relationships, especially sick, damaged relationships. And I found out, though, even after coming in the program and being in the program many 24 hours, that I still had a tendency to have sick relationships. I seem to be drawn toward that. I'm hoping that the longer that I work the program and what have you, that the less I will be in tune to do that. But I know in my group, when I first came in, my recovery was the most important thing that I had. And when people would talk about tradition, I'd want to go, ah! And boy, if you found out they're going to have a tradition meeting, don't go. Boring, God, I never had such, I felt they were the most boring things in the whole world until I got into service. And after you get a little bit of recovery, you begin to see if there wasn't the unity in the group, you wouldn't have your recovery. It doesn't appear to you that at the time. Because in our particular group, we have a very large group now, but when we started, there were two others and me. And a lot of times, we didn't have unity with the three of us. And if it hadn't have been someone showing us how to work the tradition, you know, because everybody wants their own way, you know. It's, you know, nobody runs it, but everybody tries. And that's the way we were in our group. And that's the way I did in the relationship. It's real funny, but the same way I practiced my sickness, I practiced that in my relationships. And I took it to my group. Okay, I had to force myself to go and do. And my husband's sponsor said in the beginning, my sponsor's husband, I'll get it right in a minute, said that when God created his first church, had there been traditions, there'd still be one church today. But because everybody was going to change it and make it better, that they got divided. And, you know, that's one of the neat things about our traditions is that it's standardized, that everybody's trying to do the same thing at the same time. And everybody's working. And if you notice, all the traditions are based on the first tradition of unity. All the rest of the traditions come together in order to reinforce unity. Every one of them. And that's the way this is, too, in your relationships. I found that where groups do not follow the traditions, and I have been to groups that did not follow the traditions, that after a while those groups pass away. They die and go on. They have lots of problems. And that was the way I was doing in my relationship. So some qualities that I found that were necessary in unity to promote the unity and maintain unity in a relationship, I was going to have willingness was going to be the first thing. I've got to be willing to do my part, to listen to the ideas and feelings of others in the relationship. I've got to be willing to be wrong sometimes. That hurts. I have to be willing to do more than what I feel is exactly half in a relationship. You know, I heard all my life that we're 50-50, we're partners. Have you ever been in a relationship where it was 50-50? 90-10 at best. And there's days when it's 90% you and 10% them, and then it's the next day when it's 10% you and 90% them. That's always fluctuating. I have never been in a situation where it was just totally 50-50. That would seem ideal, but I don't see that as a standard that I'm going to have to look forward to as a goal. I think what I want to do is to find out over the long haul that I am doing what I need to be doing in that relationship. Acceptance is another quality. It's one of the greatest forms of love that one person can give another. Not demanding anybody to change so that you don't have to. You know, all my life I went around wanting everybody else to change so I'd be happy instead of accepting them like they are. You know, all I ever wanted was for people to accept me like I was, and that was the one thing I would not do for them. I was demented. Good orderly direction. Now, this is my contact with a higher power, and without it, it's unlikely that I'm going to be happy in any relationship. God has to be the touchstone for me. Out of my good orderly directions, I'm going to know what to do and not to do. That's one of the promises. Intuitively, we will know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. And I know that there's something greater than either one of us in that relationship. That person cannot be my higher power, the other person in the relationship, and it was for a long time. Because whatever the other person in the relationship did dictated what I would do. I was a reactor. I didn't know how to respond or to act, but I knew how to react. So I would wait for them to do something so you'd know what to do. All my life I did stuff like this. Honesty, I believe, is very vital. Determining exactly what my feelings are, being honest with myself and not blaming others. Blaming others is one of the most damaging things that we can do to a relationship, is that pointing the finger and saying, if you had have done this or if you had done that, if you hadn't have done this, if you hadn't have done that. If blaming is the answer, if it's somebody else's fault, I'm here to tell you that there's no hope for you because you're powerless over other people. But if what you're doing is causing some of your own discomfort, there is hope because you can change yourself if you choose to. But for years, I went around blaming people. If my mother hadn't have done this, if my daddy hadn't have died, if the teacher had been better, if my first husband hadn't have done this, if my boyfriend hadn't have done that, if my second husband hadn't have done this, it was always somebody else, and my boss. I always had an excuse for why I was feeling the way I was feeling. I never took responsibility for those feelings. And that is being very dishonest, because I and I alone generate my feelings. I have a choice. Okay, communication. It's the first thing to go in an alcoholic situation. It's the last thing to come back. Very, very difficult to communicate. There are necessary skills that have to be developed, and you've got to be willing to make yourself vulnerable and say what's truly in your heart. I had a hard time with this with my husband because I was afraid to make myself vulnerable because he might hurt me again. It took a long time to develop trust. And to be willing to be hurt, realizing there's no hurt that I'm going to have that my higher power can't take care of. And it's unrealistic to think you're going to trippy-toe through life without being hurt. You know, pain's inevitable. Misery's optional. And I didn't know that. I thought that, that we were supposed to live without pain, but pain has been my greatest helper because pain's my motivator. When I hurt bad enough on something, then I'm willing to change and do it differently. So I'm not afraid of pain like I once was. I don't enjoy pain. I'm not masochistic. I don't get off on it. But sometimes you would think so, to the degree I will hang on to it sometimes. But I only hang on as long as I can. Okay, open-mindedness. Being willing to listen and be open to someone else's feelings, their ideas, their opinions, and being willing to change an attitude, my own, in order to bring unity into that relationship. I always felt, this is mine, it's my belief, it's my thought, it's my opinion. I didn't know the difference between those three things, thoughts, ideas, and opinions. I had no idea. But I would dig in, and whenever you would try to tell me something different, you were wrong, and I would hang on to mine. And instead of being willing to look and see if there was any merit in the other one, I would sit there in my self-centeredness, and I would refuse to do that because it wasn't what I wanted. But if you're going to work on a relationship, you've got to be willing to be wrong and sometimes change your mind about things. Be willing to open and listen to something else, honestly. Well, unity to me doesn't mean that my husband and I are always in agreement on things or other relationships. But it means that we are willing to allow each other to have the different views. We're going to give each other the right to be themselves instead of being a carbon copy of myself. Unity means that we're willing to disagree agreeably. It means that we're willing to work together, regardless if we have the same opinion. My husband and I both have goals, and our goals are not always the same. But we have one area that's a common bond, and that is the fellowship of this program and the fact that we are both working a 12-step program. We have very little in common. We're nothing alike in personality. Our likes and dislikes, our hobbies, our feelings, we are just so totally out of whack in those areas. If you're trying to, they always tell you when you come in to find someone you can relate to. I don't relate to him at all. I just live with him. But that's part of the excitement. I wouldn't want anybody exactly like me, for God's sake. But I would act like I do when I would try to impose my opinions and stuff on you. I believe in our One Day at a Time. It talks about we want a carbon copy of ourselves. I don't want another Mary Pearl. Good God, I have enough trouble living with one I got. And I find that we complement one another. But it's only when I became willing to look at him as another person with opinions and that they could be okay even though they weren't mine. I never gave him that right before because I thought, you know, it's really funny, you meet a guy and say you're going to explain him or describe him to your parents. Have you ever said, I'm going to marry this really slobby guy and he drinks a lot, he's got a lot of character defects, but I'm going to marry him? No, I didn't do that. I said, you know, there's this really neat guy, and he's wonderful, and he's everything I've always wanted, da-da-da-da-da-da. And we got married, and the day after, I began to change him. See, I began to try to change him. He was perfect until he signed our name on the piece of paper, and that gave me custody of him. My little hostage became right there that day. You know, I took him hostage. He was mine. And I began to show him ways in which he could improve himself. I had a very nice husband. He did not do that to me. I guess he felt it was hopeless, you know, from the very beginning. But why do we have a relationship in the first place? Did it ever occur to you why you have a relationship? It occurred to me that we is better than me. That my purpose on life, you know, it seemed like in the beginning, you know, God gave Adam Eve, he gave him a helpmate, someone to be with him. So obviously it was a thing that we were going to need to be together, you know. Two are better than one. I've always heard that two heads were better than one. And I thought, well, that might be okay as long as mine wasn't one of those two. You know, one when I was doing it was always good. And I said, you know, I don't want to be alone all my life. I'm going to be around people. That doesn't mean I have to have a committed relationship all the time as far as husband and wife. Because there's a lot of widows or divorcees and what have you that can be very healthy, happy people. But that does not mean that they don't have other people in their lives, because you're always going to have other people in your lives unless you're a hermit and live off somewhere. And so I said, I've got to learn how to live with these people. And the first thing is for me to look at them is they're another one of God's kids. That we're all the same. You know, we're taught in here we're a fellowship of equals. Well, we're one of God's kids. And so, yes? We've been created to commune with one another. And if you'll notice, the steps and the traditions are worded in the plural. It doesn't say I on anything. It says we. So it means that we do best when we work together and we need help. And as individuals, we're separate entities. And that's important, to be able to stand alone and be comfortable, but to prefer to stand together. And I think many times when we come here, we have such relationships, at least I did, that we were crippled to our relationships. We had to have somebody there. I call it need versus love. I found out that after being in the program a while that the reason I married my husband in the first place was need. My husband asked me to marry him, and he said, honey, will you marry me? I need you. Oh, that sounded good to my ears. You know, need is better than love. They'll keep you longer. I know that to be true because he kept me, you know. And I kept him. I needed him just as much as he needed me. You see, I needed to be needed. And when he said that word need, me and boy, I just honed right in on that. You know, yes, yes, I'll marry you. Those were magic words to me. Not that I love you, but that I need you, because that hooked me. I always had an exaggerated need to be needed. You know, I never felt good about my own self-esteem. And when you have low self-esteem, you have a need, an over-exaggerated need to be needed. Because that's how you feel good about yourself, is when you are helping others. Now, there has always been something good, a good feeling about helping others. But when your only good feeling is when you're helping others, there's something the matter there. And that's the way I was. So I loved him because I needed him. I needed him to need me. So that was what we call love. He seemed to fill the holes that I had inside of me. And I know I have talked with many, many girls over the years about the need to have a man in your life. You know, we're pairing up for the ark. God forbid you should be left behind. And God knows that all you need is a he to take care of the she, you know. And we will go from man to man to man trying to find that instead of trying to be whole people. But after I got in the program and began personal recovery, I found that I no longer needed him to need me. Not in those sick ways anymore. I found out that today I love my husband and I need him now because I love him. I don't love him because I need him. And there is a big difference in the two. But in order to get the most from the practice of the tradition at home, both people have to be working on the relationship, and that has to be a priority. In any relationship, if you're going to have a healthy one, both parties are going to have to work on the relationship. You can't do it by yourself. A relationship is to enhance my life, not be my life. And that was another thing. My relationship was my life. And that wasn't the case. I'm a whole person today, whether I'm in a committed relationship or not. I can be a whole person without having someone else. I had lots of preconceived ideas and prejudices about a partner long before I ever had a relationship, much less a husband. I found out that because of the disease of alcoholism, I discounted him a lot. Did you ever do that? When they say something, you say, he's an alcoholic, what does he know? He's drunk, what does he, who cares what he says he feels? And I found that a lot of times the only way he could tell me how he feels was when he got drunk. Because that's the only time he felt free enough to express his feelings. And I discounted all that. He was drunk. I felt superior to him. I felt superior to people all my life. And it was based on a real deep-seated inferiority of my own. That was my way to compensate. So I had a tendency to look down at people in a relationship, and I've always been a leader. It's because I don't know how to follow. I either lead or I don't go. You know, that's that self-centeredness. And it's also a lot of fear in that statement. You have to be in charge or you feel like that you're lesser than. I never felt equal to anybody. I always felt above them or below them. I never felt equal to them. I was very, very narrow-minded. I called myself the smart and logical one in our family. I'd hate to tell you what I've done under the name of logic. I had some spiritual awakenings for me when I got in the program and determined that financial genius I wasn't, and that his drinking alcohol did not cause us our major financial problems. My reaction to his drinking alcohol caused us major financial problems. Well, if he can spend money we don't have, so can I. And he'd buy a bottle of booze and I'd go out and buy a couch. It took me several years to pay off my indebtedness. When he quit drinking, the liquor store did not advance him $3,000 or $4,000, I can tell you that. So therefore, I was the one that had done that. I learned that I never communicated properly. My husband communicates with feelings more often than not. And when he communicates with feelings, it scares me. And so I communicate back with logic. And logic and feelings do not mix. Feelings aren't necessarily facts. They just are. Now, I'm going to give you an example of how I did this. I felt so threatened by this. My husband came in. All this I'm going to be sharing with you today, the majority of it is in sobriety and in Al-Anon recovery. All right? My husband came in and he said, you know, I've always wanted a boat. That's what that is. He said, I want a boat. Now, and I watch him, and J.D. never wants anything a little bit, you know. And so I could see something in the neighborhood of a 50,000 boat arriving in our front yard, and I begin to tell him we don't have a place to put it. We can't afford it. Besides, you don't need it. He said, why do I not need it? And I said, well, we're members down at the local fishing place, and they furnish, part of the membership is they furnish a boat and all. And I said, why have to have a trailer, pay taxes, license? Man, I went into a big logic here. But what the bottom line was, I was afraid. I was afraid that he was going to put us in great financial indebtedness by wanting this boat. And so I began to explain to him logically why he didn't need it. And he would shut up for a while. And a few weeks or months would go by, and the boat would come up again. And once again, the fear would come back to me. And I didn't realize that's what it was. It just seemed to me that it was a stupid idea. I never got in touch with what feeling I was having. I automatically will come back with logic. And so logically, I would explain to him again why this was not feasible. And we went through this for several years. And then I went to a communications workshop. And the lady was talking about not communicating on the same level, and I had no idea what she said. You can communicate on logic, you can communicate in fear, you can communicate in feelings. And she said, but you can't communicate when one is in logic and the other is in feelings because the two do not add up. It's like trying to compare apples to beans. It just doesn't compare. And I realized. And another thing that I realized going home from that workshop, I had 12 hours from that workshop to where I lived, and I got to thinking about it. What I did was I took a man's dreams and I cut them down time after time after time. And I thought that was probably one of the most cruel things that I had ever done to him, was repeatedly in other areas on things that he had dreamed about and his little wants and stuff that I designated as insignificant, not necessary, you've got to cost justify it to me, that I couldn't do that to him. And this had damaged our relationship. And I thought, I don't communicate with him on feelings at all. I always communicate with logic because I was afraid to become vulnerable. He might hurt me if I use a feeling. I can fight you with logic. But God, when you get down in my guts on those feelings, I can't handle it. And so I went back to my husband and I told him, I said, I want to tell you what I learned. And I'm going to shut up about the boat. I said, if you want a boat, you go and have your boat and do whatever you want to do with your boat. I said, I don't want to walk on your dreams anymore. And he said, I really don't want a boat. And I said, then what the hell have we been fighting for 5 years? And he said, you wouldn't let me have a boat. He said, that's the part. He said, you wouldn't allow me. And he said, when you told me I couldn't, he said, that became a quest. Well, I can relate to that. I don't like people tell me what I can do and can't do either. But when I sit down and then I had to share with him the total truth, see. And I said, I was afraid to share feelings with you. And he said, why? And I said, when you said boat, I got fearful. And when I get fearful, when you get scared, you begin to build up the defense. And the best attack is a counter. You know what I'm saying? The best counterattack is another attack. So I said, there I was. And he said, why did that scare you? He said, I was just talking. And I said, because I began to be financially insecure the moment you talked about boat. He said, well, what did you think I wanted? And I said, well, God, it had to be a cabin cruiser, knowing you. And he said, I wanted a little John boat. Just a little fishing boat. That's all I wanted. And I said, I still didn't understand why when we had one. And he said, did it ever occur to you that I might want to go someplace other than down to the club to fish? No. Because all my life, my mom and daddy went down there, and I went down there with them. And it's been in the family for years, and it never occurred to me that when we had a place that was, you know, 20 minutes from the house, why bother to go 300 miles and buy a boat, motor, and trailer to do it? It honestly never occurred to me. And he said, I don't enjoy fishing down there. They changed the lake. They have skiing down there now. It's real hard to fish when they're skiing. And he said, I would like to go someplace else. Well, see, that made sense, but see, I had never sat down and had a communication with him, listened to what he said, and then talk with him about the feelings, and then worry about the logic and what have you. And we communicated for the first time. JD's got his little fishing boat. He's used it twice. It's been sitting out in the yard now for 2 years. But did you know something? I don't really give a damn. I went with him. And we enjoyed it. We went together, and even if you don't catch anything, we just sat out there in the boat, and we rode around on the lake, and we sat there, and we talked to one another. And did you know some of my most pleasant memories of my childhood was going fishing with my dad? And I guess I just didn't want to do that with someone else, but I have found that JD and I have got a special closeness because we've been going out on the lake, the boat that I fought so hard because it wasn't logical. Because I didn't know how to deal with feelings and I couldn't communicate and I wasn't trying. So you see, when I begin to try to work on the relationship, things begin to happen. It's just like when you begin to try to work on yourself, how things begin to happen in recovery. I didn't know. You know, I found that I need to know what my needs are, and I didn't know what my needs are. I knew what my wants are. My wants change every day. What I want today, I may not want tomorrow. But I didn't know what my needs were. And so I had lots of needs, you know. So I had to come up with exactly what I wanted and needed, what I needed to have out of that particular relationship, and then express that to my partner. You know, so many times we expect people to be mind readers. You know, sometimes I need a hug from my partner. Sometimes I need a stroke from my partner. Sometimes I need a kiss from my partner. Sometimes I need a "you're okay" from my partner. And I need to, when I'm wanting those things and I don't get them, then I get upset. And I get vengeful, resentful, instead of expressing. And you see, I always felt like, if you love me, you ought to know. If you love me, you should be able to read my mind. What's the matter, you dummy? I mean, it's degrading to have to ask somebody to hug you. Not if you want the hug bad enough, it isn't. You know, I found that when I started expressing to him what my needs were, he began to express back what his needs were. And we were really surprised at some of the needs that we had. Having him read my mind, you know, that's stupid. And the bottom line is, it doesn't work. So if it doesn't work, why keep using something that doesn't work? Balance. I only wanted my way. I had to let go let God, and let my partner have a say. And sometimes God talks to me through my partner. It's nauseating. Absolutely. When it happens that way. I found that my husband is a lot smarter than what I gave him credit for. You know, the only smart thing I figured he'd ever done was get me. You know, J.D. prayed a lot. He prayed for me to shut up. That's not my way. Why bother to say in 25 words what you can say for 3 weeks? I found that I have a tendency to harp. I didn't know that. I found that what I was doing was trying to tell you something, and if you didn't agree with me, then I just hadn't got the right words yet. And so then I would think about it, and I would come at you again at another time and, you know, present my case again a little more eloquently this time. And if you still didn't agree with me, then I'd back up, and I would wait a while, and we would reattack instead of realizing that you weren't buying what I had to sell here. That self is so hard to get rid of. And I would even call people in the program and talk with them, and they would agree with me that this was a good thing. And it may be a good thing, but it may have been something that my partner wanted to participate in. I found, too, that there's ways of communicating to my partner about doing things. You know, in Al-Anon, I was taught that whether my partner participated or not, I could do things if I wanted to. If I said, I would like to go to the show this afternoon, and he said, I don't want to go, that I could go ahead and go anyway. But I noticed, like I say, with one of the boys that I sponsored, he was never doing anything with his wife, and it occurred to me, I said, how do you ask her to go? And he said, well, I tell her that me and the kids are going. You want to go too? And I said, I don't believe that's the right way to do that. And I realized that a lot of times I'm guilty of that same kind of thing. Because when you talk with each other, you will hear the things that you're guilty of. And so I found that when I go to my husband and I would say, I'm thinking about doing something, what do you think about it? How do you feel about it? And then we can make joint decisions. And he feels a little better about the invitation than when I tell him it's already pre-planned, and if he likes to go, that's fine, but I'm going without you anyway. And that was the way I was doing stuff, because, see, I was taking care of myself. So it's called selfishness, but it's putting aside what I want for the good of the relationship. I had to learn to live within our means. That was one of the things that was hurting our relationship. I had a tendency to want to go and rape them all. I realized that I was a compulsive, impulsive spender. And the worst yet was if I took somebody with me. You know, I did bad enough on my own, but if I took somebody with me, I did twice as bad. And I said, why am I doing that? And it's because my ego was such I had to show you that I had the money to do it with. Well, I didn't. You know, it was obvious when the bills came in that I didn't. Okay, taking time for my partner. I took time for my program. I took time to work with people I sponsored. I took time for everybody, and I put the time for my partner last. And I didn't realize I did that. J.D. and I have a standing date for Thursdays. That's our night to howl. We do different things on Thursday night, but that's our night. And of all the nights in the week, now we may get together a lot of other times during the course of a week. I'm gone a lot of times on the weekends, just like right now. But when I got home one time, several years ago, J.D. said, would you be my sponsor? And I said, what? I said, the voice flipped this time. And he said, well, I'd like to have some uninterrupted time, and they seem to be able to do it much easier than I do. Oh, I looked at that, and I was guilty. I was guilty. I didn't realize how I always put him last, because if I came in the house and the phone rang and J.D. was sitting there trying to tell me something happened to him that day, I'd put him on hold and I'd take the call. So we have an answering machine at our house. And when J.D. and I are talking, the answering machine does the answering, and I don't. I didn't realize how I did him that way. But when I began to work on this, it was real funny. God began to give me instances and show me things where I was not doing my part as a partner in a relationship. Okay, prayer and meditation on my part. I pray and meditate about my relationship. That's another thing that I do. I had to learn how to do that. To pray and ask God, show me ways to improve my relationship. Show me what I am doing that's hurting my relationship. And when you pray about these things and you meditate on them, you will see. You will not want to see a lot of times, but God will put these things right in front of you, the things that you are doing that's hurting your relationship. I had to use acceptance of progress rather than perfection. I'm a perfectionist by nature, and you're doomed to failure when you are, because nobody's perfect.
And I would want progress for a little while, and then I'd want to get real good. And I would find that there were days and I would do real good in this relationship and that things would be going, and then we would have a little blow up over here at the side. And I'd say, how did that happen? See, I was wanting perfection. And I couldn't accept the fact that there's going to be good days and bad days in relationships. Just like, you know, I don't get up feeling good every day, do y'all? I don't. And some the days that I get up and I'm not in a good place, and if I'm not in a good place with my higher power, I will not be in a good place in my relationship that day. Because the bottom line, how well I function in a relationship is always going to come back to how well I am doing. How well I'm doing. Finding things to praise instead of things to bitch about. Now, I'm a compulsive bitcher. There can be 50 things done right, and I will find the one thing you haven't done. It will stand out. So, I'll see it first. I don't know why I have that ability to do that, but I do. And I have to really work on myself not to mention it. Instead, find something good. J.D. and I would leave town for a long time. We played this little stick game. And he would say, is there anything you would like for me to do around here while you're gone? So I would make him a list of things that I would like done. And when I would come home, not one thing on the list had been done. And I would look around, and he had done other things, but the things that he had asked me to write on the list. And so after several times of this, I looked at him one day and I said, what is the purpose of the list? Is this for you to be sure and not do those things? You know what it is I want and you're not going to do them? Is that the purpose of the list? And he said, no, it's just that after I look at that, I'll say, I don't want to do that. I want to do this. And he said, do I not have a right to change my mind about what I want to do? Because now think about yourself. I wasn't giving him the same right that I take frequently. Haven't you ever sat in your house and said, I really need to dust? Come on, dust. I'll clean out a closet. And everybody will come in, and they don't know that the inside of the closet is clean, but they can sure see the dust. You know? And that's the way I was doing him. I wasn't paying any attention to the things. I found that when I praise him for the things he's done, he feels a lot better about doing other things. I'd always heard that you catch somebody with sugar more than you do vinegar, but it never occurred to me that by doing that, I was constantly beating him down by pointing out his shortcomings or the things he didn't do. I didn't realize how defeating that was. Terribly defeating. There's no victims in a relationship. I don't believe in victims, only volunteers. We volunteer for the sickness. We are not victims. If you sit there in a bad situation and don't do something about it, it's sort of like if you're the only hog left in the pen, hog you it. That is your part. And I know that I hurt myself and my partner by trying to change him for his own good. That was my I know best syndrome. You know, you always heard about father knows best. Well, Murphy knows best. Everything there is, Murphy knew best, yeah. But I don't know best. So now let's move on to tradition two. Now the way we worded this one was, for our family or relationship purpose, there is but one authority, a loving God, as he expresses himself in our family conscience. Each partner is God's trusted servant, and neither governs. Well, as you know by now, I've always been a dominating individual in my relationships. The attitude in which I play God made me feel indispensable, and it also gave me the power to manage and control. And God, I love that. I was in charge, but on the other hand, that also means you're responsible. When you're in charge and it goes wrong, it's your fault. Well, I didn't like that. Now, when someone allows me to dominate, that means they have no responsibility, and when something goes wrong, it's not their fault. So I had lots of fear. I couldn't afford to make mistakes. I don't know if you've been that way. My self-esteem was such that if I made mistakes, I felt like I was a mistake. And so I was so responsible at times that I would call and try to get people to co-sign my bullshit. Did you ever do that? When you're doing something, you call and try to, and you call until you find, and if you call long enough, you will find someone that will agree with you. I felt that was what was so important about my sponsor was that she never would co-sign my mess. She just wouldn't do it, you know. But I knew who in the group would, you know. So if I really wanted that, I'd call. But if I really wanted to do something, you know who to call and who not to call. You know the one that's going to agree with you, and you know the one that's going to hurt your feelings and tell you the truth, you know. When things went right, I took 100% of the credit. Thank you very much. And you see, a big vital part was missing there. God was not in the relationship. I was in charge. And I found that this tradition suggests that a group conscience is needed, an informed group conscience. Now, there's a big difference between a pure democracy and a group conscience. It took me a long time to understand that, too, until I started working in the area assembly at home. It was amazing to me how we could get up and scream and holler and cuss at one another and have the biggest darn fights and then have a unanimous vote on something. That always amazed me. How do we do that? And it was because we stopped, we went back, we thought about it, and we prayed about it. And then when we'd come back and vote, we would have a different answer. Because when everybody was touching God, the answer was going to be unanimous. That was what the key was. So in our relationship, I said, now, I don't see how you can do this, group conscience, when you've only got two people. Well, you can't. But you can do it when you got God and two people. And so J.D. and I would find lots of areas in which we would find disagreement. Well, we would talk to each other, and we finally got to the point, like I say, where we could communicate to one another. And he'd hear what I was saying, and I'd hear what he was saying. And maybe we still didn't change our minds. Maybe we were still both dug in. Well, then we would make an agreement that we would go and we'd pray about it. We'd meet back a week from tonight and we would talk about it again and see where we got. And did you know, sometimes we had to go and do that two or three times, but the bottom line was during that period of time, maybe a third solution would happen, come up, that we hadn't seen before. Maybe I could give and negotiate a little here. Maybe he could be a little flexible there. And we found out that when we brought God into it, that we always got what was best for us. That doesn't mean we always made the right decision. But we always felt that neither one of us was to blame. We learned that we could accept the disappointments and the fact that we do make mistakes, but we didn't have to point fingers at one another because we had touched God. We didn't have to blame one another when it went wrong. And always before, you'd sit there and say, well, I knew I shouldn't have done that. It's all his fault. He taught me into it. Or he'd do the same. But we don't have to do that anymore. There is no fault anymore. Because when God is in control, I think that when it goes wrong according to how we see it, it's God giving us an opportunity to learn something that we need to learn. I don't see it as wrong. I have always looked at things backwards. What I thought was good was not necessarily good, and what I thought was bad wasn't necessarily bad. Because the worst things that's happened to me in my life have been the turning points of my life that caused me to change and do better. Because you learn by what works, by what doesn't work. I've never learned it the other way around. So it's amazing how much peace will come into your relationship when you check with God. And when you have God in the middle. It's amazing. And we both share the blame sometimes if it doesn't go the way, or we will say there is no blame. We know that God's given us an opportunity to learn, a period of growth, and we don't have to hurt each other and damage our relationship when something goes wrong. We can pull together instead of pushing apart. Another area that I had to work on was making a commitment. Making a commitment for somebody other than myself. Did you ever, someone say, would y'all like to come over for supper? And you say, yes. And then you go home and tell him what he's going to do. So-and-so's invited us to dinner, and I said, we'd go. And he said, that's good. Go and have a good time. But how am I going to tell them? I don't know. You managed to tell them to begin with. Maybe you can find another way to tell. You know, I kept answering for him. Yes, he'd like to do this. My husband's a welder. And you'd be surprised how many of your friends, when they find out your husband's a welder, have broken things that need to be fixed. And they'd say, well, J.D., could you get J.D. to weld this? No problem. J.D.'d come in from work, and I'd say, now, honey, you need to go over to so-and-so's house and fix this. And he said, I've welded all day long there, Pearl. I am not going over there and weld it. But you have to. Why do I have to? I told him you would. He said, then you go weld it. I don't weld. Then you shouldn't make commitments for welders. Welders forget and make commitments too. My husband doesn't cook. We were having a potluck at his AA group, and he said, my wife will make brownies. He says, I'll bring brownies to the potluck. And he came home and he said, you're supposed to make brownies for the potluck. And I said, what potluck? And he said, the one that they're having at the AA meeting. And I said, did you sign me down for brownies? He said, yes. And I said, I'm not a member of the AA group. I said, you shouldn't make commitments for my cooking. And he said, well, if you're going to be that way about it, I'll just make them. And I said, okay. So came the night before the potluck, and J.D.'s running around, and he's saying, when are you going to make the brownies? I said, I'm not. I said, I'm not making brownies. Those are your brownies. I didn't commit to make brownies. You committed brownies. I didn't. He said, you know I only cook hot dogs. I said, well, make them look like brownies. So off he went to the store, and he came back, and he had some brownie mix, and he made brownies, and it was all I could do to stay out of the kitchen and not show him how. I swear to God it was. You know how we are. And I sat in the living room and tried so hard to, I can't tell you what was on TV, but I was looking straight at it, because I was listening to the brownie making in the kitchen, you know. And you've never seen anybody so proud in all their life as when he walked out with his brownies. And all day at the potluck, he was saying, have a brownie, have a brownie. And they were good. He did good, you know. But it to show you, though, the other day he came in and he said, we're going to be having our anniversary, and they want to know what we're going to bring. He said, what would you like to cook and bring, if you will, to the potluck? And I said, well, when is it? And he told me, and I said, J.D., I'm going to be in Georgia that weekend. He said, I guess you'll be making baked beans then, are you? And I said, no. I said, you didn't put me down for baked beans. He said, no. I said, I'd ask her. And see, there's the difference. There's the difference. Not coming home and telling each other what to do, but ask. And I found that it was very simple when somebody would say, would you like to come to dinner? Would y'all like to come to dinner? And I'll say, let me check with JD and I'll get back with you. I don't know why that was so hard for me to before. You know, I'm the one that makes decisions, you know. But I was making decisions for people that wasn't my business to do that for. And that if you're going to work as a unit, then you have to consult the other person. Okay. When unity doesn't exist, love cannot exist either without being damaged. And I didn't know that. You see, in many ways, I caused this damage in the relationship. Because, you know, in our literature, it says love cannot exist without a dimension of justice. And there's not justice when one person is running the relationship. So I killed a lot of the love that we had, and we had to reestablish love. And the sick relationship had to die in order that a healthy one could begin. You can't hang on to half of the sick thinking it's going to work. You've got to be willing to let go of it all and then start to rebuild again. Humility exists when this tradition is practiced because God is in charge. In the second tradition, God is in charge, not us. So neither one of us get an ego trip. Now, you know, making decisions before, to show you how crazy we were, we went out to buy a new vehicle. And J.D. wanted a sports car. I didn't want a sports car. I'm too big for a sports car. I don't want a car you have to put on and take off. I want a station wagon. J.D. said, I don't want a bus. He said, why do we need a station wagon? So we compromised. We bought a truck. Nobody wanted that. Now, that's the kind of decisions you make like that, you know. Just a little bit of insanity. We fought over control. One of the biggest areas we fought over control was the TV. When we bought the TV and got remote controls, have you ever had a couple of remote controls? The guy said, you need to buy two. He said, because she'll be in one chair and you'll be in another. And I thought, and yes, and that TV will be going blip, 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 blip. I said, no, just one control is all I want. And JD said, yes, I suppose you want it. And I said, sometimes. So we found that we could work out the control of the TV. And he does. He's one of these. He's a channel flipper. Do you hate channel flippers? I hate channel flippers. And you never, you know, it's amazing to me how they figure out what they want to watch when you only see 3 seconds of it. You know, and I can be there, and that, I mean, that really gets on my nerves. So when that starts, I have to leave the room, either that or I pull out my hair. But we took time, so, and we said, okay, Monday night, neither one of us go to the meeting. Tuesday night is his meeting. I have control of the TV when he's not there. He has control of the TV when I'm not there. That's logical. All right, then we're home. We have sometimes together on Mondays and Thursdays. Mondays are mine, Thursdays are his. He has first choice. And it's just that simple. We don't fight over it. But you'd be surprised. Now, that may sound like a little bitty thing, but that was a big area because we would get hurt feelings. We would get mad at one another because there was something. And you know the real stupidity of this? There's another TV in the big room. But who wants to watch the little bitty screen? And besides, we're both old enough if we lay down to watch, we're asleep and we miss the whole damn thing. Right now, J.D. is into the biting his nail syndrome. You see, the Olympics are on and I'm a sports nut. And so he has told me, he did this, he relinquished control of the TV while the Olympics are on. And any time that I'm home, I can watch the Olympics if I want to. And that's the first time he's ever done that. And that's a real nice thing to me. Because, like I say, we've always fought over it before. And he'd scream, stuff still on again? And I'd say, yes, it's on. He'd say, how long is that on? I said, at least 2.5 weeks. But my husband does not care for sports. You know, it's just reverse normal situations. You know, that you lose a husband on Monday night for the football and all. In our house, it's me that goes for that stuff, not him. But he has been very, very nice and generous this time. And I didn't even ask him to. That's the neat part. He volunteered it. How important is it? How important is it? That was one of the things that was big at our house. I make mountains out of molehills. I have to quit creating crisis. You know, I think that in step two, being restored to sanity, that means that I don't have to do the things that I always did, which is creating a crisis to get my way, or knowing how to deal with something. If you get it blown up, you know, when you don't know how to make little decisions, you blow them up into major decisions. So then you know what to do with them. You panic, scream, holler, throw a fit, cry, call the neighbors. You know, you know how to handle those. I found that many times I made mountains over molehills in our relationship. And just like his little boat, how important was it? Well, you see, when the feelings come in, it magnifies importance. Feelings have a tendency to exaggerate whatever is happening for me, the feelings. Okay, I've had relationship problems with other family members. So has J.D. J.D. and my mother have been having a relationship problem. I have to stay out of that. I have my own to work out. I cannot work out his for him. I see a lot of areas in which I think I know what he could do that would be different. But I have learned in this program that the last person in the world you help is that close family member. You lose credibility because you're in the family. For whatever reason, I have tried with my sister and my mother both to get them into Al-Anon in the early years of being in the program. You can't carry the message to the family for whatever reason. You can talk to a complete stranger and make more impact than you can. And I think it's the credibility gap. So I just have to let him work out his own situation with my mother. I've had a problem with her too again. Our relationship is, she chose earlier this year not to have a relationship with me. And so that's been difficult too. And to have what type of relationship that you can, but as we're going to talk about in one of the other traditions, the very next one, it makes a big difference when you've only got one person working on it. When you leave a relationship, now I have had to leave relationships with husbands, with friends, with enemies. You know, even a relationship with an enemy is a relationship. I had a sponsorship relationship, which I had to leave. I find that if I honestly express the reasons why I am disassociating, why I'm leaving that relationship, it may hurt the person, but it may also help them in future relationships. If I know why, you know, if you ever had somebody just disappear out of your life and you didn't know why, or every time you called they weren't there or this kind of thing, and you knew that they were breaking the relationship and you always wondered, what did I do? I think that we owe it to the other person to tell them why we're leaving the relationship. I think that we need to be honest with them, but try not to be brutal. Try not to be brutal. And I had to do this, especially in a sponsor relationship I had with someone. I had to tell them that I could no longer sponsor them, that there was total dishonesty in our relationship, and I could not deal with the dishonesty. And I know that when you're sponsoring people, you realize that people are prone to exaggerate things. But this particular person seemed to be a pathological liar, and I never could. It's hard to give somebody some suggestions when you're never dealing with the reality, when you're never dealing with truth. And I had to disassociate myself. Tradition 3. Two or more persons, when gathered together for mutual benefit, may call themselves a relationship. And the only basic requirement for a good marriage or relationship is a mutual desire to be in that relationship and to make it work. One person can't make a relationship work. You have to have mutual desire and mutual work. You must allow others to go at their own pace, however. And J.D. and I swap back and forth on this. Some days I'm going to be in more growth. Some days he's going to be in more growth. And we go back and forth. Some days he appears not to be a part of. He doesn't appear to be willing. He doesn't appear to be working on his part of the relationship. And then some days that's my attitude. I get up this morning to say to hell with it. You know, just some days that's the way it is. I feel that when either one of us is in a bad place physically, emotionally, or spiritually, it's much harder to work on your relationship because you're working more than just trying to survive on your own individual recovery. And we have little left over for relationships. And some days we just have to hang on. But that's not the rule. That's the exception to the rule.
why have I been in past relationships? I started looking at some of my past relationships. Now, my first husband, why was I in that relationship? And why I stayed in that relationship was even more of a mystery to me. I knew that why I got in it was to leave home. I wanted to get away from mother, and I didn't have the courage to do it on my own, so I got married because, you know, two is easier to get away from. That's a normal thing when you leave home. After I had been married about 2 weeks, I realized that I really didn't want to be there, and I'd made a mistake, and I hung on for 7 years. Now, why, when you know 2 weeks after you're married you shouldn't be there, do you hang on for 7 years? I was trapped. That's why I hung on. I had a fear of insecurity. I didn't know what else to do. I had confusion. I was ashamed to tell somebody that I'd made a mistake. I didn't want anybody to know. So my pride held me back. And then there was the financial security. I wanted material things, and he was able to provide those things. So I stayed on because I liked the gravy that I got. Then I had the parental pressure. You're making your bed, you lie in it. Don't come crawling back here if it doesn't work out. I'll drop dead before I do, and I darn near did. There's never been any divorces in our family. You can't put that stigma on your family, for God's sake. And then there's pity, not love. You know, a lot of times we call love a lot of things, but in this case, I felt sorry for the boy. I was going to help him. I felt sorry for him. I didn't want to be an old maid either. That was another reason I had gotten married. I didn't want to be an old maid. My God, I was 19. Everybody I knew was married. That shows you how crazy, you know, we're not too mature, you know. I heard the other day that the best way to deal with teenagers is to treat them like they're escapees from a mental institution. And I think that's pretty true, because I was crazy up until I was in my 30s, and then it just went downhill. But I stayed in that relationship when I wasn't getting anything out of it. And I think that a lot of times I enjoyed being tortured. I think I got off on the pain. I must have to have stayed what I did. And how do you get out of that relationship? Well, I can tell you how I did it as a sick person. What you do is you find another relationship, because you don't let go of one till you got you another one. You know, a bird in the hand is worth two husbands in the bush. I found that I had to accept my partner as a total different person than myself and see him as he is, not what I wanted him to be, not what he could be. I had to quit looking at his potential. And not my idea of what his position should be. And honesty is very vital here, and it was hard for me to do. It was very hard for me to look and accept him as he was, because, you see, I'd always seen him how I wanted him to be, so when I would have to look at him like he was, it seemed like I was shortchanged. But, and that was because I never saw him like he really was. When I began to see him as he really was, I realized he had a lot of the qualities that I thought he didn't have. I had just not seen him in the way that I wanted to see him. You know, we have very funny vision. Okay, in my first marriage, like I say, I didn't want to go back home to mother. I was afraid of what will your friends think? You know, you develop a whole set of friends when you're married. Now, what are your friends going to, are they going to drop you when you get a divorce? Sometimes they do. And sometimes you don't feel comfortable around them anymore, especially if they're still associating with your ex. It's like, I don't want them to drop me, but I want them to drop him. Those kind of things. And especially I found in the program, when people have separations or divorce in the program, they feel real funny about going around the people in the fellowship. So it's easier to stay, even in a bad marriage, than to be a failure. That was my thing. It was easier to stay. That's just like when I married J.D. and then the alcoholism got so bad. Why did I stay? Why did I stay? I had already had one bad marriage. My ego said, you can't afford to have another one. So you stay in a bad situation. It's easier to stay with the known than to jump out into the unknown. That's one of the reasons that you stay. And besides, you know you have to stay till you have someone else waiting. That's just the way it went back in those days. God forbid we're a woman alone. There's a terrible stigma. Being a widow is honorable. Divorcee, mm-mm. You know, that's the reason I felt like he had to die. But alcoholism is a very slow-killing disease. Things that hurt that relationship badly. Okay? Fear. In that first relationship, I was unwilling to be honest about my feelings. I was afraid to say how I felt. My obsessions. I'm addicted to excitement. My drug of choice is adrenaline any day. I love excitement. I was addicted to attention. I wanted a lot of attention.
All right, I had a lot of boredom. I didn't know that boredom was a character defect, and that, did you know that bored people are usually boring? Usually goes along the line. So I would create crisis to keep from being bored. And I'm an extremist. I don't do anything a little bit. I got me a hobby when I was overseas in that first marriage, and I devoted 12 hours a day to that hobby. I got real good at it. Anything that you devote that much time to, you get real good at. And my husband began to not see me. He was working on the Air Force, and he would be on alert, and he would be gone for a week at a time, and I wouldn't even know he was gone. I was doing ceramics. I became the greatest ceramist of all time. Man, I was just making them pots, ashtrays, making them ashtrays. And the funny part about it was I had to take up smoking and smoke a lot more to use up all my ashtrays. And you all, and there was a point of honor about having ashes in every tray in the house, you know, and people would come in and they'd look at all these ashes, I made them. And then I went from there to flower pots, and I don't grow flowers that well. My husband is the one that grows flowers. Okay, another thing that I did was, that hurt my relationship was withholding sex. I know none of y'all have ever done that. I call it the dog yummy syndrome. You do good, you get some. You don't do good, you don't get your gummy. I used it as a punishment for real and imagined hurts both. That hurts your relationship. Justification and rationalization hurt my relationship. Judging hurt my relationship. Always finding fault. Why did I say? Because I chose to. The bottom line, because I chose to. I had other options, but I chose to. Now, I know that if my relationship with anyone is going to work, I must want to have that relationship with them. And I must be willing to work on my part. Willing to work on my part. Some days I'm willing, some days when self takes over, I'm not too willing. Being honest about my feelings is scary because it makes me vulnerable, but it's necessary. I can't ask my husband to be a mind reader, and I hate trying to read his mind because 9 times out of 10 I miss the mark. He's real funny. He'll do the same thing 47 times, and on 48 he changes. I never have understood. The most consistent thing about him is inconsistency. I have to tell him what's important to me and what is not. You know, a lot of times he does things because he thinks that's what I want, and it's not what I want. And I have to be willing to give up some of my character defects, like, say, the bitching. And I have to realize that the bitching is one of the things that really hurts my relationship with J.D. It doesn't always hurt some of the other relationships I have to the degree that it does him. Because J.D., it really hurts him for me to continue to do this. So I have tried desperately to stop doing that. And I can't do it by myself. I have to have help from my higher power with that. That's the only way I know to deal with it, is become willing to stop griping about things. And instead, I guess I was just born a nag. I don't know what happened to me. But along the life, I just got into the habit of dwelling in the negative. And I really have to concentrate not on doing that today. Tradition 4. Each partner should be autonomous except in matters affecting the other partner, the family, or society as a whole. Okay, autonomy, we know, means that we have the freedom to do whatever we want to, but we have the responsibility for whatever we've done. And so I take this through autonomy. I can do nothing I want to. I can do anything I want to if I think and I ask my higher power first if the action I'm considering is going to affect my partner or my relationship first. And before, I did stuff automatically. I never stopped to run this path. Is this action I'm going to take going to hurt my partner? Now, there's a difference between making mad and hurting. There's a big difference. Because I can't live my life wondering if every little thing I do is going to make him mad. That's not what we talk about here. There's just been getting mad and getting hurt. There are lots of things that I do that my partner doesn't like, but he's not my God. And just as there are things he does that I don't like, and I have to accept a part of his nature. His boss is God. My boss is God. And if he's doing what he feels like God would have him to do, who am I to say that he shouldn't be doing that? In order to be autonomous, I have to first know who I am. I am God's kid. I am more than just a wife. I'm more than just a homemaker. I'm more than just a worker, an Al-Anon, a mother, what have you. I've got to consult my higher power and find out exactly where I am with him. And I ask my God, should I do this and should I do not? And if I don't have an answer that I can discern, I have learned over the years, if in doubt, leave it out. My autonomous actions, I have to be careful, because when my instincts are out of line, they'll take me to the mall. Impulsive spending adversely affects my relationship with my partner. I've been known to spend hundreds of dollars in an afternoon, never giving thought to the consequences. I have a tendency to look at things three times and say, oh, I want that, I want that, I want that, I need that. My wants can change to needs instantaneously. It affected my relationship. It affected society as a whole. You know, when you have to pay them off slowly, that's called slow pay. And so now you're in trouble with an institution, and in turn, when you don't pay your bills, sometimes other people have to pay them for you because they raise the price to take care of people who pay slow. That's just like if you shoplift at the grocery store, the other people in the store are having to pay for your shoplifting. So those little things that we do that we don't think affects anybody else does affect other people. Another situation that hurt my relationship was to fantasize. I always fantasized about how he could be. Or have you ever fantasized about someone else being your partner, looking at somebody else and start making a comparison? That's always good, too. This can be a very damaging thing, because the more you compare, the more dissatisfied you become in the relationship. And if you think on it long enough, you can also find yourself planning an affair, which will certainly damage your relationship. And it'll happen so gradually, you'll be unaware of it happening until, lo and behold, you do something silly, and then you want to see yourself as a victim. I was so vulnerable. I wasn't getting my needs met at home. You probably would if you'd looked there. You wouldn't have strayed at all if you'd been getting your needs met at home. That's just telling yourself a bunch of bull. There's no victims. There's volunteers. It's important not to allow someone or something to become your higher power. Ego-driven individuals rarely have a healthy relationship, and I was an ego-driven individual. I want things my way or no way at all. And I blow it off with, I'm just a natural born leader, just like I told you all ago. And I just say, that's the way it is. But what it meant is, I want my things my way. I want to be in charge. I don't want to be left to the mercy of others. And I'm self-centered. And with that autonomy, I damaged my relationships. Because that's called self-will run right. And I've had sick relationships like this all my life because I'm not practicing this properly. With my first friend, I had my first girlfriend in life was a little girl named Shirley. And I did things because I wanted to, and if she didn't like it, that was tough. And I felt like, because our family had more money than hers, that she was subservient to me. Really felt that way. Now, I mean, 5 years old, and I felt that way. I needed to be the top dog, or I wasn't going to be no dog at all. When Shirley and I got in junior high school, and she began to develop, and her personality began to really show up at that time, I kept her down for a long time. And I would see other people being attracted to Shirley. I would go behind her back, and I would tell them rotten, nasty lies about Shirley so they wouldn't have anything to do with her. Because I didn't want to share her. That was an autonomous action I took. And it damaged Shirley. It damaged a lot of things. That was one of those hard things to have to make an amends for. Do you know Shirley and I are still friends to this day? She is one of the most loving, forgiving people I have ever known in my life because I did things to her all the time we were growing up.